Hi FM, your station of choice since 2008.
It is 8:26 in South Africa. I'm Howard Feldman. This is your morning mayhem. It's 101.9 Chai FM. How significant is it, Jerusalem Day, Yom Yerushalayim, from a historical perspective? Professor Richard Landis joins us. He's an Israeli historian and author. Thank you for doing so. How are you doing?
All right.
How significant is this day? Is it a day that has been created just to note the fact that Jerusalem was reunified, or is there a very, very much deeper and more meaningful notion of what Yom Yerushalayim is?
I would call that a leading question, but yes.
Yes. Yeah. So give me a sense of what that means.
Well, look, I mean, obviously, since the time of David, that's 3,000 years ago, Jerusalem has been the center of Jewish religiosity. In the 1850s, the majority of the inhabitants of Jerusalem were Jewish, according to an Ottoman census. The reunification, the division of the city in 1948 was literally a knife in the heart of Israeli identity. And there's an interesting irony in this, because at the time that the division between an Arab nation and a Jewish nation in former Palestine was being prepared, a day before the ceasefire, there was an attempt, one final attempt on the part of the Israelis to invade and take the old city. Uh-huh. And it failed. And the irony is that if it had succeeded, then the international community would have insisted that the city be an entity apart under international control, which would have been a disaster on many different levels. But since the city was not, the old city was not in the hands of the Jews, but in the hands of the Arabs, the world community did nothing. And as a result, when Israel actually took back that part of Jerusalem in 1967, the world community was not in a position to say, oh, now that you have it, we're going to take it away. So ironically, our failure in 48 set up our success in 67. And, you know, it's an astonishing event, which clearly gets up the nose of a lot of people, because every single solution, in scare quotes, for the Arab-Israeli conflict includes giving back this city, which was literally the result of Jewish religiosity, to the Palestinians, who, until we showed interest in it, showed no interest in it. In fact, at my blog, I have a picture of, in a post about mimetic desire, I have a post of a picture of the Temple Mount in 1954 when it was under Jordanian control, and there are weeds growing everywhere. There are two Muslim men standing there, the whole place is abandoned. And then as soon as the Israelis take it over, it becomes the third most valuable, the third most sacred place in Islam, repeated endlessly by phony scholars in the West. So yes, it's hugely important, and its importance clearly disturbs many people.
Right. In terms of that aspect of it, is it not a significant holy site for Islam? Is that what you're saying?
Look, it was an important holy site, but it was an important holy site because of the building of the Dome of the Rock, which incidentally, your listeners should know, is the first stone building in the history of Islam. Up to that point, they were in full end of times mode and didn't build anything permanent. It's the first permanent building. It is, according to some people, and I agree with them, an attempt to build the third temple.
Interesting.
Yeah. And so its significance is entirely in terms of Judaism. In the apocalyptic lore of Islam, the Kaaba stone from Mecca will magically transport to Jerusalem for the last judgment. So their focus on Jerusalem is entirely related to their dependence and their derivation from Judaism, and their insistence that it be theirs and that their third most holy site should trump Jews' single most holy site is literally an expression of their triumphalist attitude that they must dominate wherever they are. And if they don't dominate, it calls into question their faith in their own religion. So it's a very sad situation in which the world, the outside world, literally sides with exactly the wrong people.
That is according to Professor Richard Landers. Thank you, as always, Israeli historian and author. I'm sorry we have to cut short, but it is 8:30.
I thought we were going to talk about. From the river to the sea.
You know what? In fact, let's do that. Hold on during the news headlines and let's come back to you.
Okay.
Chai FM, your station of choice since 2008.
It is 8:32. Professor Richard Landis has stayed with us. He wants to talk about From the River to the Sea. Tell us more.
So I think you asked me when we first discussed this conversation about Bibi's claiming that From the River to the Sea is the equivalent of some Nazi statement.
Yes.
So I think it's important, first of all, for your listeners to understand that the original in Arabic, the chant in Arabic is not From the River to the Sea, Palestine will be free, which is for infidel consumption. It's From the River to the Sea, Palestine will be Arab. And by that is meant Arab Muslim. It will be Muslim. And it's an expression of a deeply felt, again, triumphalist, imperialist Muslim attitude that they must control all the land in what they consider Dar al-Islam. And we're now living with a generation of people who believe that Dar al-Islam should be a global caliphate. So the idea that From the River to the Sea, Palestine will be free is some kind of liberation theology is literally, to get it backwards, it's an imperialist ideology which is intended to wipe out the freedom of the Jews, because the freedom of the Jews is precisely what a triumphalist Muslim can't tolerate. The fact that we walk upright, comme miut, and not hunched over like Vimy, apologizing for our very existence, that's an affront to a triumphalist Muslim. It's not an affront to a real Muslim. It's not an affront to a Muslim who genuinely has faith in Allah. But it is an affront to a Muslim for whom, if his religion doesn't visibly dominate, he is in doubt about his religion and has to change that largely through violence. So it may not be the equivalent of Heil Hitler, but in some senses, and certainly in the hands of a group like Hamas, it is exactly that. I mean, Hamas is directed...
Because it is a Judenfrei. It is making sure that there are no Jews in Israel,
and Hamas is a direct inheritor of Nazi ideology. The Nazis who fled, there were a whole bunch of Nazis who fled to the Middle East. They went to Egypt. They went to Syria. They converted to Islam, and they turned the ideology of Der Stürmer and Goebbels into an Islamic key. So in the 1930s is when you have the revival of a hadith that had lain unattended for over 1,000 years, calling for the extermination of the Jews before the last judgment. And that's in the Hamas charter. So we're dealing with a genocidal ideology that is chanting From the River to the Sea. And you'll excuse my English here, useful, imbecilic infidels in the West repeat this as if it's an idea, a liberation theology.
And the fact is that the the strategy around propaganda has been very much mimicked as well. Repeat a lie over and over. Yep. Until it just becomes the norm and becomes acceptable.
Yep. And that's what's happened. And shockingly, since October 7th, when Hamas really revealed what they would do. I mean, we're looking at Hamas for 12 hours, able to do whatever they want to do. And what do? They kill every single Jew they can, torture them horribly, take them as hostages and so on. You can't get a better illustration of genocidal intent. The next day, they accuse Israel of genocide before Israel is even struck back, and the world picks this up. I mean, if you look at CNN, you will find that every mention of genocide since October 7th is related to accusations against Israel. At no point do they discuss the genocidal intent and actions of Hamas. So you literally have a West that is systematically misinformed by their own mainstream media and funneling jihadi propaganda that is poison to the West into the Western public sphere.
Professor Richard Landis, that's where we do need to leave it, Israeli historian and author. Give me your reaction on WhatsApp 061-895-1019. It is 8:38.